A very warm welcome. I'm Georgie Frost. You're listening to Consuming Issues here on Share Radio. I'm with you from 9 until 1 every weekday, making the pound in your pocket go a little bit further. The team from This Is Money, the award-winning finance section of the Mail Online, join me in the studio for our weekly catch-up. Editor Simon Lambert, journalist Lee Boyce, here today to talk through the top stories that they've been investigating, including how long before the sub 1% home loan, the cheapest ever fixed rate deals, break new ground in a mortgage price war. But be warned, read the small print. With calls for more protection as well for private renters, are rent controls the answer?
They should have longer tenancies, five-year tenancies. We need to crack down on rogue landlords, revenge evictions and the worst conditions that you see in private rented homes.
Also, can we trust our banks? Millions more put aside for dodgy doings. Profit drops, branch closures, it goes on. Will it end? And has anything been learnt from the financial crash?
We are regulating the banks much better now. The banks have more money stashed away in their vaults. What's worrying is that there's still too much debt.
Could diesel cars become a thing of the past? Now you can really put your money where your mouth is by investing in your favourite sports teams. And the summer is coming. Fire up the lawnmower as the battle's hot up. And it's the final This Is Money show before the election. The leaders of the main political parties put their final pitches in the last live TV showdown. Much of the talk about coalitions.
I'm saying let's have a decisive outcome and these things don't have to be compromised on.
I want a majority Labour government. You ask me about coalitions, they're not going to happen.
It just seems to me a pretty old-fashioned principle. The party that has got its nose ahead of the other parties got the mandate to try and put together a government.
So sticking with politics on TV, what does that, 50 Shades of Grey and Alan Titchmarsh all have in common? Well, they all come out on top of a poll of the most mind-numbing things. Yes, we want to know today, what bores you? Also in amongst this, rice crackers in at number 23. More boring than rice crackers, Ed Miliband in at 16. Though David Cameron, slightly more interesting than rice crackers. A very good morning, Simon Lambert. A very good morning, Lee Boyce.
Good morning. I'm going to go with reality TV programmes.
Good choice.
I find them incredibly dull. And it's just the sheer volume of reality TV programmes. And specifically ones like Traffic Cops or something like that. What lazy television. I mean, if you're the BBC, right, you've got a pretty privileged position.
If you've got one of those
five, you know, main channels, you've got a really privileged position, okay, because you've got access to all the homes in the land with a TV. So put some proper programmes on. Don't just go follow some blokes round in a police car. That's not television. Put some drama on. Write a programme. Tell you what, actually, in theatres across the land, on a daily basis, there are people putting on plays, and some of those plays are amazingly good. Wouldn't it be better to just go film a really good play for an hour and put that on the television rather than Traffic Cops?
That's part of your
manifesto. Criticism.
Constructive criticism. Lee, yourself, what bores you?
Can I just say, firstly, looking at this list...
You're loving it. I shouldn't have given you this list.
Just below filing in tax returns is cricket, bargain hunt and snooker, which are three of life's absolute gems.
Yeah. Well, I don't
understand this.
Hunt,
I mean, Bargain Hunt is sexy television. I'm actually going to be a bit boring and stick with Simon, actually, on this one. I was going to say reality TV, but more sort of like talent contests. You know, sort of like Britain's Got Talent, X Factor. How long can these shows keep going on every year? You've seen one magician. I don't need to see another magician. You know, it's just all the same sort of stuff. I've seen one average singer. And it's all of that horrible way that they portray people, go to their back, sob stories, all of that sort of stuff. I can't stand it. It is absolute switch-off television for
me. My favourite one on here is Small Talk. So that's basically just other people, isn't it?
Just above Anna Titchmarsh.
I'm gonna blow your mind and say, do you know what bores me the most?
Go on.
Comes in at number 11. Ooh. Sort of. People talking about football chat. I know you're looking shocking here because
I'm not really football.
I do like football.
You do it for a living.
I do do it for a living. And I don't necessarily mind football pundits as long as I keep it quite tight. But bravado, when you're in a pub and you're talking with people and they've probably seen these players for about 2 minutes on YouTube max or 10 minutes on Match of the Day if you're lucky and you're the best player since anything, what do you know? And yet they'll go on about
chat.
It for about... informed football chat, I can take. People talking in the pub, a lot of rubbish about football bores me. One of the saddest parts of this poll, 34% people think they bore themselves.
That's really quite sad.
To celebrate Share Radio's first year, we're giving away a Pure Evoke D2 digital radio every single week. Many lucky winners have already received theirs, and you could be next. To enter, visit shareradio.co.uk, register your details, and you'll be entered into the weekly draw. Open to UK residents over the age of 16. Visit our website for full terms and conditions. Share Radio, sharing ideas about money.
A very warm welcome. If you have just joined us, I'm Georgie Frost. Editor Simon Lambert, journalist Lee Boyce from This Is Money, the award-winning financial website and money section of the Mail Online. Join me live in the studio. Hopefully, we will not be boring you for the next hour. Coming up, many are calling it a housing crisis, but for private tenants, are rent controls the answer? But first, there's something of a price war, a mortgage price war going on at the moment. The Co-op caused a stir with the launch of its 1.9% fixed rate home loan. Sounds good, but too good to be true. And here I spoke to personal finance expert from Share Radio, Ed Bowsher.
40% deposit, yeah. So, you know, if you're a first-time buyer, you're almost certainly not going to be able to qualify for this, which is a great shame. The fee at £1,500 is higher than sort of the average. The sort of average mortgage fee is about £920. And also, when you look at mortgages, always, or fixed-rate mortgages, where you're locked in for 2 or 3 or 5 years, have a look at the exit fees as well. If you want to get out early, you will be charged an exit fee. With the Co-op, you'll be charged. If you want to get out early within the first year, we charged a 2%, that's 2% of the whole mortgage, or 1% after a year.
So, Simon, Lee, what do you make of Co-op's offering?
These mortgage rates are exceptionally cheap. So you could fix your mortgage at 1.09% for 2 years.
Give us some context. Give us some context.
So before the financial crisis, you probably would have been looking at 4%, more than 4%. And what we've seen, you know, since then is obviously interest rates shuttled down to 0.5% just after the financial crisis, and their mortgage rates stayed high for quite some time. But over the past 2 or 3 years, they've really come down a lot. And actually, they've come down a huge amount since last summer, which is basically the point at which people pretty much decided that interest rates weren't going anywhere anytime soon. The cost of borrowing on the money markets for banks fell substantially. Savings rates are down quite a bit, so banks are getting cheap money. They can still access cheap money from this funding for lending scheme, which they can't get any more new cash from, but there's money in the pot. So we've seen a bit of a mortgage price war, and we have seen the 2-year fixed rate fall towards 1%. And it's not beyond the realms of possibility that you might be able to fix your mortgage below 1% for 2 years soon. You can actually already fix your mortgage for 5 years at below 2%, which is very, very cheap. But as Ed pointed out there, you've got to watch out for the other charges here, fees. These fees can be pretty big, and any other things that get loaded onto the loan and mean that it might not be the best value.
How can you work out if it is the best value?
Handily enough, we've got a calculator. It's our true cost mortgage calculator. If you go to This Is Money, in the middle of the top of the homepage, there is a button that says calculators, and that takes you to our true cost mortgage calculator, where you can plug in the rate and the fee and work out whether how two different deals compare. And what we do here when we write about these rates is we do compare them. And Mark Shoffman, one of our journalists, has compared this Co-op rate with another rate from the West Bromwich Building Society. And that highlights the difference here in that the West Brom rate is slightly higher. It's 1.19% versus 1.09%, but it comes with a lower fee of £999. And when you plug it in, that actually works out £483 cheaper over those 2 years. So getting a bit into the geekiness here, but it does illustrate how sometimes paying a slightly higher rate can actually save you some money. The key thing to look at, though, with these mortgages is that they are exceptionally cheap. If you've got a big deposit, you're going to be the real winner. But even if you've got a smaller deposit, they look pretty good. And if you've got a mortgage and it's on a higher rate, potentially you might be on the lender's standard variable rate, which they could change at any time, and those average more than 4%, you could be free to leave and you could remortgage and save yourself potentially hundreds of pounds every month, which adds up to more than £1,000 in a year. And that's a huge saving, because for most people, their mortgage is their biggest outlay. So now is a very good time to be looking at cutting the cost on your mortgage.
What does that 1.09 transfer to after 2 years? My concern is it sounds very similar to the teaser rates of the past, of bygone bad eras. After you come off that 2 year and interest rates predicted to go up as well, what then?
Well, that's the thing. And so, I mean, I've been writing about mortgages for a long time. Before I was the editor, I used to be our sort of mortgages and property writer. And personally, I've always favoured the 5 year fixed rate because it gives you more certainty. You've got a longer period of time that your mortgage payments are locked in. And most people tend to move around about a sort of 5 year cycle, closer to 5 years than to 2 years. You know, it's very rare that someone buys a property, lives there for only 2 years, and then moves on. And the other advantage you've got is that you get that lower rate for longer. You might have to pay a little bit more on the rate, but you probably save yourself money over time because you won't have to remortgage when rates are potentially going up. But also, you don't have to pay these fees multiple times. So if you took out a 5 year fixed rate, you'll only pay a fee once in 5 years. If you take out a 2 year one, you'll pay the fee twice in those 5 years. And actually, once you start adding those fees up, it can make those 2 year fixed rates more expensive.
Lee, how do they justify the discrepancy in these fees? Isn't it just an extra charge so they can get away with offering these low rates?
Well, it is. It's a lot of it is the attractive headline rate. So, you know, people will look at that headline rate and go, wow, that is a good rate. And that's why it is important to use, you know, a calculator such as the one we have on our website to make sure that you're factoring in all the costs. And the other thing I was going to add, actually, is although we're going through record mortgage rates, it's no coincidence that savings rates have also collapsed. So, OK, on one hand, we're having record low mortgage rates. On the other hand, saving rates have collapsed. And Simon touched on it just now. A big reason for that is the funding for lending scheme, which has allowed banks and building societies to tap into this big pot of cash to then lend out in the form of mortgages. Before that, they'd have to offer attractive savings rates to get the money in to then lend out. But there hasn't been much of a need to do that in, you know, recent years. So it means savings rates have collapsed. So people who want a return on their traditional savings accounts are getting nothing, basically.
The thing I would add to that is that mortgage rates could go up. I mean, they could go down. They could continue to fall further. There's every possibility that they could go down a bit further. But they are very, very low at the moment. So you wonder how much lower they could get. And with every month that passes, we do theoretically move closer to an interest rate rise. They're looking at the US raising interest rates in summer. You might see a situation where the money markets turn around and go, no, actually, we think rates are going to rise a little bit sooner than we think, because that outlook has been pushed a long way back over the last sort of 9 months or so. So rates could start to rise. So if you do think that you might be disappointed if you were going to miss out on one of these low rates, then you have to make the decision, do I take it now or do I gamble they're going to go a bit lower? And to be honest, if they fall a little bit lower, you probably wouldn't save that much more money.
Well, from mortgage price wars to rent controls for private tenants. Before we do that, I will ask you too, the average person in the UK could apparently be costing themselves nearly £1,500 a year by not saving wisely. A survey's found more than a third of people don't know the difference between a savings account and a cash ISA. In the case of ISAs, you don't pay tax on the interest you earn. Well, Martin Upton is from the Open University, which carried out the poll.
If you've been putting money into interest-bearing savings accounts in recent years, you've been, in most cases, earning less than the rate of inflation. So your money's been going down in real value. So you've been hit by inflation risk.
Simon Lee, your views?
I think it's true. I'll tell you what, if I had one tip for people who are saving money, it would be don't just look at your money you're saving now into new savings accounts, because people can be quite good about saving that into one with a decent rate. It's look at your old ones. Loads of people have old legacy accounts sitting around that basically banks and building societies have done the dirty on them, and they offer better rates on new accounts, but with the old ones, they just allow them to slide down and slide down. And whilst you might be getting, say, 1.5% on a new instant access savings account, you might be getting 0.3% on an old one. So, you know, look at those old savings and move them to a better rate.
Lee?
I absolutely agree with Simon there. You need to be having a look at your old accounts, especially if you... It's quite easy to open up numerous savings accounts and just let it slide and think, well, it was 2% when I opened it, so I'm sure it's 2% now. But as we were touching just a moment ago about teaser rates, you know, teaser rates are rife in the savings world. So, you know, it is important to make sure that your money is working as hard as it can. And It is also important still, I think, to fill up your cash ISA allowance, which is tax-free. You know, you save away from the tax man. Limit now is £5,240 for this financial year. If you've got pots from previous years, you could make that money really work hard if you've got a quite substantial sum. OK, we're talking top ISA rates at the moment of 1.5%. It's hardly exciting stuff, but it's still tax-free and it's probably the best savings vehicle that's still out there.
Journalist Lee Boyce, editor Simon Lambert from This Is Money in the studio with me. Coming up, it looks like more bad news for the banks.
Consuming issues with Georgie Frost. Making the pound in your pocket go that little bit further.
This is Kenneth Branagh with an urgent message from the Disasters Emergency Committee. On the 25th of April, Nepal was rocked by its worst earthquake in 80 years. More than 3,000 people are dead and hundreds of thousands fleeing from their homes. DEC member agencies in the area are working around the clock to provide food, shelter, clean water and bedding to ease the suffering of those affected. Please help now by going to the DEC website or calling 0370 60 60 900 to make a donation. Thank you.
Consuming issues with Georgie Frost. Making the pound in your pocket go that little bit further.
We were talking about mortgages at record lows. Let's take a look then at Esher in Surrey, shall we? Most expensive place in the UK outside of London to rent a two-bedroom property. So from buying to renting. That's according to the website Rightmove. The average home there would set you back nearly £2,000 a month. Are rent caps the way to go? Simon, you've been looking into this rather extensively.
Well, this comes from the fact that earlier this week, as part of their sort of election push, the Labour Party and Ed Miliband came out with this suggestion that they were going to go out and help something that's dubbed Generation Rent. What this all sort of boils down to, I think, is this chunk of people who they're dubbed Generation Rent because, you know, they're renting a home, but renting a home is quite normal. So why are we calling them like a special name in a generation? It's like, well, because basically they want to buy, but they can't buy. And understandably, they're quite annoyed by the fact they have to save massive deposits to buy a home. And also, rents look pretty expensive compared to those mortgage rates we were talking about. If you can get one of those cheap mortgage rates, then you might be paying less than the rent. Now, one of the suggestions is that they would like to cap rents, put controls on them, so that basically they would introduce three-year tenancies as the norm, and rents would only be allowed to go up by inflation during those three-year tenancies. But I think that there's actually a problem with this, which is it's very hard to think of any scenario where prices have been linked to inflation where prices don't rise at that rate. I mean, there's no reason why they'd have to. You know, you could cap them at inflation and they might rise by less or they might fall. And actually, the thing about the rental market is that basically I think there's a bit of London-centric politicking and London-centric media going on here. The London rental market is brutal. And we decide that that is basically the same situation around the rest of the country. And that's not true. The situation that you see in London where flats rent in a day, landlords will happily kick out perfectly good tenants or hike the rent by a load of money, just does not occur across the country. So it happens in some hotspots. I would say probably in some places like Manchester and stuff like that, especially the popular areas, some of this London-style stuff is going on. But actually, when you drill down into the figures, rents have risen by more than inflation over the past 5 years. In fact, they've risen by 4.1% more than inflation. But actually, when you break it down, that only comes from three places. It comes from London, which is up 16.7% more than inflation, the east of England, where rents are up 6.7% more than inflation, and the southeast, where rents are up 3.6% more than inflation. In every other region of England and Wales, rents have risen by less than inflation. So actually, if you had have linked rents to inflation with rent controls, in most places in the country, they would have gone up by more over the past 5 years rather than less.
Well, earlier I spoke to Pete Jeffries from the housing and homelessness charity Shelter.
The long-term solution to the housing shortage is building more homes. But in the short term, we've got to do more to protect private renters in particular, because they're a group who have very little security, very expensive rents. It's more than a quarter of Londoners now are private renters, so it's a huge group of people. And what we're saying on that front is that they should have longer tenancies, five-year tenancies should be available for families to give them a bit of security, where rents can't rise more than inflation. And we need to crack down on rogue landlords, revenge evictions, and the worst conditions that you see in private rented homes as well, to protect families from poor housing, which can lead to really bad health conditions.
Lots of things there I'm sure we can't argue with. But again, that magic L word, London as well. Is it worth starting to think of London as a separate place and doing policies for it, Lee?
I'm going to give my £2 worth on this, because I am part of Generation Rent. You know, I've rented in London for the last 10 years, on and off. Now, the biggest problem I find is that I can't buy in London. You know, there's no way I can buy a house in London. It's too expensive, and I don't know if I'd want to anyway. Now, I could probably afford to go and buy in commuter land. You know, thinking of my hometown in Essex, property is much more affordable. I could do it. You know, I could probably get on the housing ladder there. The big problem is actually train fares. I actually think if train fares came down a little bit, season tickets were more reasonable. And this is very London-centric, by the way. You know, the rest of the country, I think, is completely immune from this. There's so many people that come into London commuting. You're talking millions of people. But it's a fine balance of, you know, if I get a mortgage in Essex, I've then got to factor in season ticket. By the time I've added those two things together, that's probably going to be my rent in London. But I'm buying time because I'm living in London and my commute shorter. Now, I actually think a big burning issue in the South East is train fares. And you look at some of the prices to come into London now, talking from Brighton, Southend, you know, these very popular places, £5,000-6,000 a year to come in. If there was some sort of way we could link, you know, if you're going to take some pressure off the London market and say that here's some sort of scheme, if you get a mortgage or you buy a house outside of the South East and we're going to give you some sort of subsidised train travel for a handful of years, I think we could be talking about the crisis in London becoming a bit of a thing of the past. And that's my views. And as I said, that's very London-centric. But
Interesting views. None of this is doing anything to resolve the housing crisis in terms of supply.
No, it's not. But the interesting thing about this is that basically there's a lot of people out there who think the buy-to-let is the devil's work. But ultimately, social landlords and institutional landlords, which people are hoping would step in and replace all these buy-to-let landlords, they've pretty much bowed out of the rental market. They've indicated that they are just not really that interested. You know, the rise of the buy-to-let landlord has come at a time when there's been a vacancy opened up in the rental market by social and institutional landlords saying, no, we're not interested. So there isn't the supply. Maybe there does need to be more of a supply of social housing and institutional landlords, but I'm not sure that some of these things being put forward help that. And so I think London, and I think to go back to what we were saying, London is an exceptional case, and you can't make policy for the rest of the UK based on the fact that stuff in London is crazy. People just don't feel they have any choice in London. So it's like you either take that overpriced flat or you pay whatever demand is being placed on you by the agent, and you pay their ridiculous double charging fees where they're charging you for something and charging the landlord for something at the same time, or you're out on your ear. And you don't want to be out on your ear, because then it's like, oh, well, where do I find next? I mean, our old flat we were previously renting, it quite literally rented in less than a day. It went on the market on Friday night at 7:30. It was just listed on Gumtree. By midday on Saturday, there were three people competing to sign on the dotted line to rent it. But that scenario just doesn't really happen across the whole of the country. I mean, if you look at these figures, since 2010, the average rent in London has gone up by nearly £3,000 a year, which is a lot of money. In the North East, the average rent has gone up by £240 a year. It's a similar level around Wales. It's a bit more in places like Yorkshire, the North West, the West Midlands. It's only London, the South East, the East of England, where you've seen these massive increases.
So great if you're not in London. Bad luck, Lee.
Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost, making the pound in your pocket go that little bit further.
Now let's turn our attention to our banks. Yes, you know, it's been a bad week for the banks when one announces their quarterly figures, and it's good news that they've not had to put aside extra millions to cover future fines and legal fees. Lloyds were down £660 million, though, as a result of the sale of TSB, but hurrah, no more provisions at the moment to cover the mis-selling of PPI. We will put aside the fact that they've put £1.7 billion already aside for such matters. But taxpayer-owned RBS, though, well, they slumped to a loss cost of £446 million, blaming restructuring costs and so-called litigation and conduct. And Barclays revealed it had set aside nearly £1 billion for past misconduct. Challenger Bank TSB is closing 17 branches ahead of its £1.7 billion takeover. Part of plans, they say, to keep a lid on costs after a reported 67% fall in its quarterly profits. Well, its boss, Paul Pester, has told the BBC that the whole industry needed to rebuild customers' trust. He said, "I'd be amazed if people trust our banks. In the banking crisis, they lost connection with their purpose. They lost connection with the role they play in the wider community and the societies they serve. But will anything change? Has anything been learnt from the financial crisis with regard to our banks?"
Yes, it has. And I would say that our banks are better places than they were in 2007. I would say that they are genuinely more concerned about their customers. They are most likely much less involved in ripping them off.
Even though a lot of these fines came in after
they are aware of their previous bad behaviour, and they are sort of potentially desiring to do something about it and push the customer angle rather than the sort of rampaging investment angle that they were pushing before the financial crisis. Whether they are necessarily appealing particularly to customers and the man on the street, I don't think so. I don't think people like banks. We don't like banks. We're still unhappy with banks. It's going to take a long time before we are any happier with our banks.
But are they changing because they have to? Because they've been told to by the EU, by regulators? Or is actually a cultural change happening? Lee, your views?
I think there has been a bit of a cultural change. You know, talking about Lloyds, I mean, when I was first working for This Is Money, did quite a few investigations about how staff in branches, you know, were pushing products on people when they shouldn't have been, all in the name to hit targets. Now, what I'm being told is that, you know, the noise is from Lloyds that they've stripped back these targets and it's all about, you know, actually helping the customer. How much of that's true, I don't know. But it's going to be difficult for these big banks, especially with expensive sort of legacy systems, all that stuff, to be making profit and doing all that sort of stuff that's going to please, you know, shareholders and whatnot. But on the other hand, you know, customers now have quite a bit more choice. There's a few challenger banks coming out, there's more coming out in the future. And there's a lot of people talking about, you know, current account switching. It seems to be more of a drive for people to switch current accounts, for example, which is quite a big part of a bank because you're more likely to have a mortgage with them or other products. Places like Santander, Santander and Halifax have been the two big winners, the current account switch. Lloyds was quite a big loser. Barclays, quite a big loser as well. NatWest. And it's a lot of it's been driven by people looking for interest-based accounts. So, you know, will that last? I don't know. And how to rebuild trust, I guess, is just to provide a sort of service that you'd expect. You don't want to be ripped off. You know, you don't want to be missold something. You just want a bank to do what, you know, to perform your everyday needs. And if that's cutting branches, for example, I don't know if that's such a good move. But
which leads us, though, on to one of the challenger banks, TSB, also one of the losers in the great big switch. Talking about people who have switched over Nationwide, for example, gained 6,600 new customers. Santander, as you said, 43,000. Halifax, 53,000. TSB lost 4,150 overall. And yet it's part of a big change for them. And Holly Black, one of your reporters, actually went into TSB. They've started up this new branch that they're opening up. They're shutting 17, but they've opened up a new one. With the emphasis very much, they say, on the consumer. And it's interesting what you're talking about with the way it sells products as well, because they're talking about all sales data will be banned from branches. So no staff member, branch manager or regional boss will get to see what's being sold. And there are no sales targets or commission for local staff. So they say they don't feel under pressure to meet targets.
If that is genuinely the case and genuinely remains the case, then that would be a very good thing. It's unfortunate for TSB that it's closing branches, having relaunched with the phrase "Welcome back to local banking." But it does maintain that it's kind of opening these fancier new branches. My concern over fancy new bank branches is that anybody who's been into a bank branch will recognise this phenomenon. Whereas once you went into a building that had a place to queue for some counters where there were lots of people open at the counters and maybe a couple of machines dotted around, and it seemed like they were using the space to mainly serve the customers. Now you walk into this cavernous open hall where they're using most of the space for nothing at all. Some machines around the side, and then there's some counters where there's hardly any of them open, and there's a massive queue because there's nobody working on them, and there's a couple of people sort of wandering around saying, can I help
they're
you?
All,
and
it's all like,
yeah,
welcoming
go work
you.
On the counter.
Exactly. Get so behind the desk.
They've turned a little bit into sort of Apple stores. That's what I think now. There's sort of like iPads floating around and, you know, elderly customers are the most likely to go in branches because they're used to going in branches and performing everyday tasks in branches. If you start stripping away all the basics and getting rid of counters and staff that work in there and driving them onto machines that they're not comfortable with. There was a story earlier in the week about Morrisons and getting rid of self-service checkouts because people were fed up with them. They are annoying. And I think it's a similar case with banks. Now, I do think, though, that TSB, firstly, these branch closures, what they're saying is that they're in areas that's got two branches in the same town. Now, I don't know how true that is. So if there's two in one town, they're getting rid of one of them and just keeping hold of one. And they're saying that there's going to be a mix of machines to perform everyday tasks and counter staff. So we'll see how that works. But, you know, somewhere like Barclays, for example, I think something like 25% of their branches are being cut, and then another 25% are going sort of machine only. So you go into a branch and you can just perform tasks paying without, you know, there'd be one person probably circling the branch. And elderly customers don't want that.
But realistically, when was the last time we actually went into our bank branch?
But our generation.
Some people do. It's very difficult to pay in a cheque or pay in any cash without going into your bank branch, isn't it? Although now there's like some of them have introduced a thing where you can take a photo of the cheque and then you send them the photo of the cheque and that pays in the cheque.
It depends how cool your grandma is. You know, has she got an iPhone? Is she taking a snap of a cheque?
Can you take a photo of your grandma holding the cheque?
Touché. But then why spend all this money putting in iPads and touchscreen TVs into brand new TSB branches?
I don't know. If you wanted to use the internet, you'd do it at home.
Precisely.
You wouldn't go down to the bank branch to do it, would you?
I do have to say my favourite quote of this piece by Holly Black. It's rather wonderful. She went into this new branch in Enfield and she met Maureen, who's in her 70s, come to deposit some cash. She got quite a shock, she says, when she came in here after it'd been done up. She rather likes it, but there are no grills or anything that you can pull down if there's an emergency, and that worries her a little bit.
That's a very good
bless
worry.
Her. Yeah. Bless her. Bless Maureen for worrying about the staff.
The one thing I would say about our banks, actually, is that these figures at the top of this sort of current account switching thing, it's generally just quite a lot of movement amongst the big banks. Basically, it's shuffling the deck chairs. But what's interesting is actually the real challenger banks, the real new startup banks coming up down the bottom. And I don't think that I would necessarily include TSB as a challenger bank. I know they claim to be a challenger bank. They get referred to as a challenger bank. They're not. They were spun out of Lloyds, which is basically our largest retail banking group. But what's interesting is these new banks coming up. And I genuinely think that with a combination of new entrants to the market and technology, in 5 years' time, our retail banking, the banking that we all do, will look very, very different to how it does today and probably be quite a lot better. Although, if you like hanging around in branches, it probably won't be better.
Talking about new innovations and technology, oh yes, what's coming up next? We're finding out about the Rolls-Royce of lawnmowers. Yes, there is such a thing. But before we do that, editor Simon Lambert, journalist Lee Boyce from This Is Money, the award-winning financial website and money section of the Mail Online. Let's talk a little bit about diesels, shall we? Diesel cars. It's time to say a fond farewell to our diesel cars. New rules mean we have to tackle air pollution. We're already facing fines from the European Commission for failing to cut levels of nitrogen dioxide. Campaigners say diesel cars, one of the main causes of it. Plus, they're linked to a range of respiratory illnesses. So could this really be the beginning of the end for diesel cars? I'm going to have to ask you, Lee, your thoughts.
It's a really difficult one because obviously about 10, 15 years ago, diesel car sales were nowhere near the same level as petrol counterparts. Now, you know, the last few years, more people have bought into diesel than they have petrol for the first time. A large drive of this was the previous Labour government and Gordon Brown, when he was Chancellor in 2001. He overhauled vehicle excise duty. It meant that motors that emitted a high level of carbon dioxide faced higher tax. Now, diesel cars actually produce lower carbon dioxide. However, that's not a good thing.
The problem is nitrogen dioxide.
Indeed, and especially in cities, you know, it gets trapped quite easily in towns and cities. And what campaign groups are saying is that this is leading to tens of thousands of deaths every year. You know, if we can prove that, if they can prove that, I don't know. But, you know, it's not good to be breathing in diesel. Now, I thought the one interesting thing, one expert said that he believed it could be phased out via an incentivised scrappage scheme. I could imagine that actually potentially happening. But I know Simon's got a lot to say about diesel after his council.
Oh, we're getting into your council. It's about that time, actually. But I will say, though, that Edmund King of the AA warned that, and it's 11 million motorists, and he says misled into buying diesel cars during Gordon Brown's dash for diesel would feel betrayed by it. Simon, the floor's yours.
Well, the one thing I would say is that basically that's still going on. Don't just blame Gordon Brown. The car tax system still favours diesel cars. So basically, car tax is worked out on the emissions of the car, the CO2 emissions of the car. And the lower the CO2 emissions, the lower the car tax you pay. And that favours diesels because they tend to have lower CO2 emissions. And whilst there's all this concern going on about diesel cars and talk about a surcharge or a scrappage scheme, my council, Islington, has basically bought in a blanket charge. Anybody who has a residence parking permit and a diesel pays an extra £96 a year on top of their parking permit. Yet underlying that £96...
This was before these rules.
Yeah, this was before this, yeah. But even underlying that charge, they've still got parking charges rated on emissions. So they're on one hand, they're saying diesel is bad, and on the other hand, they've still got the parking charges underneath it encouraging people to buy diesel cars. So you can understand why motorists are upset about this. And there is a question here of, has it changed people's behaviour? Have people bought these diesel cars because of cheaper car tax? And when you look at it, you think, well, logically, no, you wouldn't. Because basically, say you're going to save £100 on your car tax over the course of a year by buying the diesel car. Well, the cost of a diesel car is more expensive. They generally cost about £2,000 more. They are more fuel efficient, but you have to do a lot of miles a year before that actually works in your favour. So logically, would you be buying one to save £100 a year? No. But actually, it does change people's behaviour. And when I think back about it, in my example, did I buy a diesel car because the car tax and the parking was slightly cheaper? Not solely because of that, but I think it did influence my decision. I remember we weighed up our car before now, we had an Alfa, and we weighed up the choice between the petrol and diesel ones, and the fact of the extra car tax and the extra parking charge did swing us to the diesel. So it does happen. There are millions of people who have bought diesel cars and will be buying diesel cars right now as we speak, because new cars are flying off the forecourts, because the tax system favours them. Yet at the same time, they're now being told diesel is bad and they're probably going to get whacked with an extra tax pretty soon by the government. So I think they need to sort themselves out, to be perfectly honest.
Well, the Society of Motor Manufacturers and Traders unsurprisingly hit back at this. They argue that the case against them is being overstated, saying that the latest diesel cars are the cleanest in history, with high-tech filters capturing 99% of all soot particles and exhaust after treatment, reducing emissions of nitrogen oxides by 84% since 2000, adding that overall UK nitrogen oxide emissions from passenger cars have fallen 81% since 1990, the biggest reduction, they say, of any sector. Is it just that diesel are being unfairly hit by a Supreme Court ruling finding that we're in breach and they're trying to find anything?
If you listen to drivers and motorists, it kind of like divides people. I think that there is definitely a bit of a suspicion here from people that this might be being overstated and overcooked and they don't quite believe it. So I would say that the first point for anybody wanting to bring in an extra charge or a diesel scrappage scheme or anything like that should be to lay the facts out on the table in a way that's not just trying to prove your side of the argument, because certainly that's what my council did. It basically just laid out the facts to prove its side of the argument and didn't really worry about the other side. There's an interesting thing, though, that gets raised, though, is buses. So there's a story here I've got on a website called treehugger.com. I'm presuming that that is a pro pro-environmental concerns, you know. Yeah. It says here that basically when there was the bus strike in London, all of a sudden a city that is notorious for dangerous air pollution saw a huge drop in airborne nitrogen oxide. Concentration around Oxford Street was 58 micrograms per cubic metre, while the previous four Thursdays saw average levels of 172,
wow.
So three times as much. Now, I'm guessing that when that bus strike was on, there was probably more cars on the road, wasn't there? That you'd be a reasonable assumption.
Yeah, you'd expect. Yeah. Yeah.
So, actually, there is this accusation that it might be the buses and the lorries, which all run on diesel, that are causing a lot of this pollution, and the cars might be an easier target, but not necessarily the main culprit.
On this subject, the Nissan Leaf is apparently Britain's biggest selling green car.
Mm-hmm.
According to the RAC, well, you know it, Lee, you tell me. What's going on?
Well, the thing is, there's a lot of these electric cars that are becoming popular with people now because a couple of years ago, they're very expensive, and they're still fairly expensive. I think they're about £25,000 or £30,000. That's quite a big outlay for a relatively new technology. And the biggest problem with them is battery life. So on a full charge, it's no good if you're driving far away. It's only good for a city drive. But what's happening is, as technology is improving, I think people are more inclined to buy an electric car or a hybrid car. And there's some facts, there's some stats from the SMMT here. I mean, in 2010, there was 20,000 alternative fueled vehicle registrations, and that's now over 50,000 last year. So people are starting to buy into it a little bit more, and, you know, try and cut down on their emissions. People, I guess, are more conscious. You don't see many on the road, though. I don't know how many they've sold.
You're starting to see more of is the hybrid cars that the companies are producing. Like BMW have got one called the i3, which is, it's like basically a family hatchback style sized car. And I think that can either run solely on electric, or I think it can also do electric and petrol. I might be wrong. But they've even got a supercar, the i8, which, you know, goes stupidly fast. And Jeremy Clarkson, the unemployed motoring presenter, said that he quite liked it. But we're a big fan of another one, the Renault Twizy.
Really like the
Twizy.
Yeah, Twizy is amazing. It's a little two-seater.
Yeah.
And I occasionally see them around London and they just whiz around. They're absolutely fantastic. It's like a small golf buggy almost, isn't it?
It's like a cross between a car
it.
And a motorbike.
You're
it's amazing. It's got four wheels, but the wheels sit on the outside of the body. Four wheels sit on the outside of the body. Little like cockpit that's enclosed, and it's got two seats, but the seats are one behind the other. And basically, they look like great fun. They've got a range of about 50 or 60 miles, I think, which if you live in a city and just used it to get around the city, it would be perfectly fine. And I think they look awesome. Although, do you know what? I did say when we first saw them, I did say to Lee, you know what? It'd be better with a little petrol engine in it, wouldn't it?
Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost. Making the pound in your pocket go that little bit further.
Very warm welcome. I'm Georgie Frost and this is Consuming Issues on Digital, online and through the Share Radio mobile app. I'm here from 9 until 1 every weekday. Editor Simon Lambert, journalist Lee Boyce from This Is Money, the award-winning financial website and money section of the Mail Online, in the studio with me now. Let's talk about, well, my favourite thing, shall we? It's not lawnmowers. We will talk about the best lawnmowers, though, ever. But we haven't got a lot of time, so we're going to have to squeeze that one in. I know you wait with anticipation as to what is the Rolls-Royce of lawnmowers, everybody. We will let you know. But we will also talk about, you tell people, put your money where your mouth is when it comes to bragging over our sports team. Well, now, well, you really can. Rugby union side Wasps currently moved to Coventry. Not sent there, incidentally. They actually went out of choice. They've launched a retail bond offering fans and investors a 6.5% return. The club, which owns the Ricoh Arena, hopes to raise between £25 and £35 million, becoming the first sports club to issue a retail bond on the London Stock Exchange. Wasps CEO David Armstrong told Share Radio this is a sporting first.
No rugby club or sports club has ever really done a transaction like this before. But actually, in many ways, Wasps is more than a rugby club. Since the purchase of the Ricoh Arena in Coventry, we've added onto the side of the rugby club, if you like, a full conference, exhibition, hotel, casino business. which means that rugby is actually only 35% of our turnover. And our combined business model, therefore, gives much greater financial strength and the ability to offer what we feel is an attractive, secured bond for investors. In that sense, it's unusual as a rugby club, but perhaps not so unusual as such a major venue as the Ricoh Arena. By now owning a business which is far more than just sport, we believe we've changed the mould of rugby and actually of many other sports as well. And we feel that we are one of very few businesses, if not perhaps the only one in Europe, to have this combined excellent conference and exhibition centre with an elite sports franchise.
So that was David Armstrong there. Simon, sports bonds. We saw Lancashire County Cricket Club last year at their mini bonds. Good idea. What's the difference? What's a better one?
Well, he talked a good game there about Wasps. I think that, look, these retail bonds are interesting because basically these are traded on the London Stock Exchange orb market, which means that you could buy and sell them secondhand. You put your money in, they promise to pay you 6.5% a year for 7 years, and you will get that return and then your money back at the end of it. And if you want to sell out early, you could do. If you wanted to buy in on the secondhand market before then, you could do. The crucial thing is, basically, your investment is dependent upon the solvency of Wasps Rugby Union Club. So basically, if Wasps go bust, you lose your money. Mm-hmm. And that's the important thing for anybody to remember about these bonds, is that do your research on the quality of that company and the likelihood of it going bust, and spread your risk. So if you do think that this might be a good thing to invest in, and maybe, you know, maybe you should do. And maybe if you support Wasps, you might think, oh, I wouldn't mind giving the club a bit of money and they can pay me a return that's much better than I'm going to get on a savings account. Fixed income, I don't have to worry about the value of my investment going up and down as I would do with a share. But spread your risk. You know, don't put too much money into this. Don't put all of your eggs in one basket. And these are different to the mini bonds that you see, which basically can't be bought and sold secondhand. And there's a much less stringent process for the companies trying to raise the money. So I would say that in this instance, Wasps Rugby Bond beats the Lancashire Cricket Bond. But, you know, do your research just like you would do with any other company. And Lee and me were talking about this on the way over here. There's a classic example of this, and that was football shares.
Yeah, well, I've got three views on this bond, right? I think, firstly, you have to be a Wasps fan to want to put money
into. Do you
into
get
this.
Discounts into tickets and stuff?
Well,
that's what I want to know.
You'd like to hope so. Usually with these offerings, you get some sort of preferential treatment, so you'd hope so. And the minimum investment is £2,000, so it's not a small amount of money to be putting into this. And their target is 25 to £35 million, which seems really high to me. And by May the 6th, so 1 week, I'd be very, very surprised if it attracts that much money. But yeah, talking about the football shares, I think it's that adage, isn't it? You should never bet on your own football team. And I think finance and your sporting team, I just don't think it's a good mix. And you look at how football shares have performed in the past, there are hardly any listed clubs anymore. So shares is nothing. It was almost like a novelty fact to say, look, I'm a shareholder in Millwall or Watford, or you just lost whatever money you put in it, basically. Is that worthless? Yes.
I have a prime example of that novelty factor. Do you remember when football clubs were listed on the stock market and you used to be able to buy like a sort of souvenir share, right? So basically, you could buy their share for much more than it was worth. So I'm a Watford fan. My sister-in-law, my brother-in-law bought me a Watford share. It was a sort of, you know, certificate kind of thing for much, much more than it was worth. And now I've got it and it's worth nothing.
Aww.
So there you go.
But you know what? You're a Watford fan.
Yeah, we got promoted.
So you're
so
celebrating
that's
inside,
but that's the
Simon.
Thing is that's the thing is, you know, that doesn't matter because it was what? It was like £10-15 or something for a gift. If you're talking about putting, you know, £2,000, £4,000, £10,000 into something like this Wasps Rugby Bond, then just make sure you do your homework on it.
If it did go sour, you wouldn't be a Wasps fan for much longer, would you? You'd be quite annoyed that your own club had lost you and you'd been stung on that.
Very good, very good.
Very good, very good. I do have to turn your attention, as we did promise, because, you know, this is probably the pièce de résistance of investigative journalism on your website, and it is lawnmowers. Yes, the sun is coming out. It's time to cut your lawns. Apparently it's quite competitive, the world of lawnmower. You're giggling away there, Lee. What have you found?
So basically, we had this story over the weekend about lawnmowers and investing in lawnmowers. And the guy in the story is absolutely fantastic. His name is Brian Radham. He's the author, and I never knew this even existed, of the Haynes Lawnmower Manual. So, you know, you've got all of these fantastic car manufacturers.
Wow.
Well, Lawnmower's got its own Haynes manual. So there we go. But my favourite quote is the difference. You know, people say what a lawnmower is. People have been getting it wrong for years. A lawnmower has a cylinder with blades and a roller attached that allows for a cleanly cut formal finish. Many people confuse this with a grass cutter, a machine with a rotary cutter underneath that keeps a lawn neat. So there we go. You've been calling your lawnmower the wrong thing for all these years. It's actually a grass cutter.
Although, do you know what my wife accidentally quite often calls the lawnmower? Because we've got a Flymo hover mower. She always basically refers to it as the Hoover. She's like...
Wow, I mean, that's...
She's wrong on so many levels there. Well, I can tell you, Lee and Simon, I did manage to speak to the authority on all things lawnmower, that is Brian Radham.
When you're buying a lawnmower, the decision to make is what sort of finish you want on your lawn, whether you want sort of like a formal finish, sort of striped, like a bowling green, so perfect finish and that sort of thing, or whether you just want to keep the grass neat and tidy. Because you can divide Britain in half. 50% of people love cutting the grass and 50% of people think it's a pain in the grass. Once you've sort of decided what sort of finish you want, there's different types of machines. If you're going to go for a lawnmower for a formal finish, a bit like a bowling green, that sort of thing, then it would be a cylinder lawnmower with a cylindrical cutting blade at the front with a roller at the back. It cuts like scissors, so when it cuts the blade of grass, it's like a perfect cut, and the grass recovers quicker. If you're going for a grass cutter, which would be classed as a rotary machine, that's one with a revolving blade underneath, a bit like a propeller. That sort of thrashes the grass more, so the ends of the grass rip rather than is a clean cut.
Now, Brian had this message, this special message.
Share Radio listeners, very welcome to visit the British Lawnmower Museum in sunny Southport. If you just mention Share Radio, they'll get in for half price for the next 2 months.
And, Simon Lee, I can reveal the landmark lawnmowers that made it into the This Is Money illustrious top five are the Allet Buckingham, the John Deere X100, the Flymo Robotic, the Massport Rotoroller 22-inch and the Honda HR370 electric motor. Thank you very much, journalist Lee Boyce, editor Simon Lambert from This Is Money, the award-winning financial website and money section of the Mail Online. Thank you so much for joining us.
On digital radio and online, this is Share Radio.